Welcome to the Future of Science podcast. Today we're talking to Taylor Oshin from the University of Maryland. Taylor is a geographic information scientist who has been exploring how to use and take advantage of decentralized infrastructure for geospatial data. In this podcast, we first talked a little about what geospatial data actually is. Rumor has it's about 60% of all data. Taylor then explained why decentralizing is an important effort and can increase the robustness as well as efficiency of data storage and access. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
So in your seminar, you were talking a lot about geospatial data. So can you bring us up to speed? What is geospatial data and what is it being used for?
Yeah, sounds good. So there's this, well, it's, you know, it's any type of data that can be referenced on the Earth's surface. If you're talking about geospatial or geographical data, and then we can get into this in a little bit, but the interesting thing is there's a whole like spatial data, right? If we're projecting it to a plane, it could actually be things that are more micro or larger, right? So it could actually be like an fMRI. You can treat that as a spatial data set. But generally speaking, it's the stuff that's georeferenced to the Earth's surface. And there's a quote that floats around that like X percent of all data is geospatial or has a geospatial component. And it's like 60%.
Really?
80%. Like, nobody knows, I think, where this quote started or came from. People are attempting to track it down. I think there was like a pamphlet once that was put out and they had some estimate, but you know, then it creeps up, right? And it's like all of a sudden it's 80 or it's 85. And so nobody knows exactly, but a lot of data, even if it's not explicitly geospatial already, has enough information that we could make it geospatial, right? So if that's like a string, that's a street address, you know, the computer doesn't necessarily recognize that off the bat as geospatial, but we can geocode that and then make that into a spatial format. So there's a lot of other types of information that are even less direct that we can then eventually triangulate or put it somewhere on the Earth's surface. So there's a lot of them, but you know, the typical things you think of are census data. That's geospatial data about us, but also where we live. Things like building footprints and utility networks, different assets like that, as we call, you know, vector data, points, lines, and polygons. And then on the other hand, the raster data set. So basically images, but, you know, taken from planes and satellite images. So it's a whole lot of data being collected. And with all this explosion of the, you know, small satellites, there's now thousands of them up there sending back different types of geospatial data. And they use it for all sorts of things. I mean, we use it to do precision agriculture. We use it for insurance, we use it for, you know, climate mitigation, natural disaster kind of responses, national intelligence and security. All sorts of things.
Meteorology, right? Weather reports.
Epidemiology. So, it's pretty pervasive. And there's always, you know, a lot of folks who may not consider themselves geospatial, but are actually using geospatial data and answering geospatial questions.
For sure. So I remember that in my own research, I think like most of the data sets that I was ever using with definitely had some type of geospatial information in it, right? So at the very least, for example, I knew in which country a respondent was living or in which state they were living, or in some cases we had like very detailed address information, which of course, you know, was highly sensitive.
Right. Yeah. The more you have, the more you can do with it. But then also you've got to be careful of all these different privacy and ethic questions.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe just to give us an example of the type of cool things that you can do with geospatial data. So you co-developed a method called multi-scale geographically weighted regression. So it's quite a mouthful. And then you used it in a paper that incorporates spatial context to study obesity. So can you tell us a little bit about the method? What does it do? And what did you find in that study?
Sure. Yeah. And I guess I'm going to make a little shameless plug. So we co-authored a book on that and it actually officially was released yesterday.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Congrats.
Which is cool because it's GIS Day. And so, yeah, thanks. So that's out now. And it's kind of a follow-up book. There was a book 20 something years ago on geographically weighted regression. And so this is kind of this next generation of the method. And so try not to get too technical, but
That's the challenge, I know.
Let's see. Yeah. So
ask an econometric question and then expect a non-technical answer. Very well done. Thank you.
We'll start broadly and then we can assume some technical background. But broadly speaking, the idea is to be able to capture what we call non-stationarity or spatial heterogeneity, this idea that the processes that we're interested in, they change depending on where you are. Mm-hmm. So the same stimulus can provoke a different response based on your location or your context. Mm-hmm. And so this is one method that you can use to try and measure these types of effects. There are a couple that have sort of emerged in the last few decades. And so this one is an extension that allows you to also consider that that context may change for different variables. So you might have a relationship with one thing that's very local, and then you have one that's very global in the sense that it doesn't change very much. So something that's local, it might be very different for me on the East Coast and someone on the West Coast of the US, but something that's global, we have that same kind of response to the same stimulus. So that's kind of like the bird's eye general view. Yeah. Yeah. If you're thinking in terms of, you know, if you've got a regression background and you're estimating coefficients and you think of those coefficients as, you know, you interpret them to be related to your process, right? You have a positive relation, you know, association, conditional association. So here we allow those coefficients to change based on location. And then to the extent that that change occurs, we allow it to be data driven. So we use an information criterion to estimate what the appropriate scale essentially is for that spatial variation. So that's it ends up being a very flexible kind of method that can be applied to quite a lot of stuff. And, you know, there are like different ways to think about it. So we think of spatial context as geographers, as this construct that we think exists, right? Like it's a thing that affects us. Mm-hmm. Where we live, there's like this quintessential place, right? Mm-hmm. It's not something that can be described other than place. And so the other side of that argument is, well, sure, if you could measure everything, then there would be no geographical contextual effect. But how do you measure culture, right? How do you measure the place? There are certain things, maybe you can get them in there, but it could be that they're, you know, prohibitively expensive, or it's just like there's just no way to ever measure that.
Exactly.
And so that's what we kind of consider this geographical contextual effect. And the method allows you to separate that out from those other types of spatial heterogeneities as well. So that's kind of one of the key advancements that's been pretty neat.
That's really cool. And so when you guys looked at obesity, so what's the relationship, first of all, like between your location and obesity, and then like what did you learn by applying this method in this context?
Closer to the fridge, more obese.
Closer to America.
That's one of the issues too, is like the scale at which you apply these things. So I don't have a super strong background in epidemiology as more of like a methodological person. Uh-huh. So, but I always intrigued when I can apply it to something. So this was some data in Phoenix, Arizona. And so we put kind of a bunch of the usual suspects in the model. We had some information about like if folks engaged in regular physical activity in the last year, or if they've seen a physician in the last year. So we had some of those variables and other things like age. I think income was in there. We tried a bunch of stuff. So I'd have to refresh myself on what the final specification is, but it's one of those things that's really hard to model because there's a lot of confounders, a lot of similar variables that are very correlated. And so we came up with just a small subset to kind of play with the method for the first time in this kind of application area. And so like with that contextual effect, we basically got more of like a core periphery kind of geography that was left over after we accounted for a bunch of other stuff. So this idea that it was quintessentially different if you were living in the downtown core as opposed to kind of the outskirts of the city. And Phoenix is an interesting city because it's really a multi-core city, these different really cities that are just kind of collected that are this sprawl of Phoenix. So we did see like a spatial pattern there, which was interesting, that kind of emerged. And I think from that, there's now been a lot of other applications, people looking at different health applications to see. But it's a starting point. So you start there and you say, okay, well, why do I have this core periphery pattern, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what could I do? Is there something else I could measure? So it's not necessarily that you kind of like stop there and say that's geography and it's over. You can say, okay, well, like, is there something else I might see in that pattern that sparks an idea? And plenty of things are distributed in a core periphery manner, right? So there could be something else that you then go back and think about, well, let me try that in the model and see If that changes, then what's left over in terms of geographical context?
Hey there. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. If you do, please take a sec to leave a review or subscribe to this podcast to help us reach more people. Thanks.
So one of the things that you guys were looking at in that paper was this concept of food deserts, right? So at least this is a very popular concept like urban myth that, obviously there is areas where access to a high quality and fresh foods is a bit more difficult. And sort of like the story is that if you live in one of these food deserts, that you're more likely to be obese because you may just, get all your food from the local 7-Eleven or gas station or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what you guys found, right?
We didn't find a lot of, strong associations there. And I think part of the problem is how you measure that. Mm-hmm. So food access is just, it's a very, I'm not totally an expert there, but from what I understand we used a variable that came from the USDA. So it's just a hard construct to put together. There's a lot of different things that go into measuring it. So you're kind of like modeling something in and of itself and then putting that into the model. And so I know there's some work out there that shows as well it's susceptible to things like the modifiable aerial unit problem, which is basically, what units do you use when you measure this? Are you measuring access at like a block level or a tract level? And those are different census geographies at different scales. So that level of detail, right? And is it, is it drive accessibility? Is it walk accessibility? In the US, mm-hmm. if you're not, have access to a car in a place like Phoenix, you're at a disadvantage. It's mm-hmm. not necessarily the most walkable. So it's really, that is in and of itself contextual. Mm-hmm. So what we found at the end of the day was there wasn't a lot of variation in that variable in our study area. And I think for that reason, we end up finding strong correlation. But yeah, you think to yourself, well, like surely that's got to be an issue. There's so much research there. And so it could just be that you've got to go back and try and come up with a measure that's better suited for your study area. Let's say in failure in New York City, that measure would have probably been better. It probably more reflective. But in Phoenix, it's not necessarily picking up those pockets of areas where they are being highly affected by food access.
Interesting. I see. So maybe let's take a step back from like what you can do with geospatial data and talk about geospatial data in and of itself. You gave a seminar on this, on the Future of Science seminar 2 weeks ago, which was super interesting, where you talked about decentralizing geospatial data. So you gave a bunch of arguments around the way that geospatial data is currently being provided to the geographical community or all other scientific communities is not optimal. So can you maybe speak, maybe do a quick little recap of why centralization doesn't really work? And what are the main points where you think we should decentralize the infrastructure for geospatial data? Why is that important?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting one. And I don't know if I want to say tricky, but it's like, we have a system, we have a whole, geospatial cloud kind of community, a set of protocols and specifications. So I wouldn't say that those don't work. I think that they work really well. People are getting more data than ever. But you have these interesting kind of things happening where like the data is all coming through AWS, let's say a particular data set. Mm-hmm. So you have these particular centralized portions of that kind of workflow. If you have access to that data, right? So right now, either you have the credits or the money, like you can access that and use it quite easily. But none of that is kind of guaranteed, right? Like they could change how much they're charging. They're kind of owning that data and serving it up. And I heard someone even say like, this is so great. We have an authoritative source of this data. And you're like, well, wait a minute. Is a private company supposed to be the authoritative source of this geospatial data set that comes, it's collected by the government with an open data access plan, open mission. So I don't want to say that doesn't work, right? Because like it does work well and the cloud compute environment works well. But if you're thinking to the future, that's mm-hmm. where I think, the questions arise. Like, is that where we want all of our data to be stored, especially as we're getting more and more of it from more satellites? So I think that's where it would be useful to have decentralized protocols in place. Alternatives, right? Like it can be in tandem with some of that stuff, but an additional option. And I think as scientists, right, we're always saying where it's better to be collaborative, like let's collaborate. And so I'm like, okay, you know, is there a more collaborative way that these could be stored and shared, some of these really large data sets? We're talking terabytes, petabytes, and beyond as it starts to accumulate over time.
Mm-hmm. And what would be more collaborative ways? Like, I understand that we don't want to trust Mother Amazon with all our geospatial data. So what are the things that we can do as a like collaborative community to change that?
Yeah, so that's where I think we've been looking at things like IPFS and different decentralized tools for data sharing and looking into that potential there. So we've been building that dashboard, which I presented on a little bit, and mm-hmm. I probably just kind of glossed over, but we've been making some really cool progress there. And some of our like key mantras there were like, okay, how can someone interact with data on the decentralized web and they don't even have to know that they're doing it, mm-hmm. right? It should just feel like the same user experience. Mm-hmm. But you know, they can grab the data if it's up there. And at the same time, try and get them at least interested and have the ability to contribute back to that space. So it only works if everybody's collaborating, right? If one person is doing the sharing and everyone's getting it from them, it becomes one person's burden or one organization's burden again. Mm-hmm. But if we can get, you know, more people and more organizations that are willing to participate in that network, you get that kind of knock-on effect. And so I think the dashboard has been pretty neat because it gives you, first of all, a geospatial entrance into the data. Like, let's go look at where is this data? That's what I want. But then it gives you multiple access points. So you can grab the data by clicking download or pin. You can grab the data by generating a code snippet that will use this little client that we put together that will allow you to grab the data that way as well. And so it can check if the data is on IPFS, and if it's not, it can then go look for it in other more traditional spots like an S3 bucket or something like that. So kind of mm-hmm. combining those two worlds and saying, well, like, let's use both. Why use one when we can have both?
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And then what does contributing back to that network actually look like? Like, if I see this data and I realize, oh, it's on IPFS, I think that's cool. What do I do?
Yeah, so it basically involves having your own local IPFS node set up. So they have a desktop application. There's a command line application utility. So having that running, and then in our case, you would be pinning that file. So pinning is just a lot like, you know, storing it persistently, saying I have it here. So if you had the file, my whole understanding of it is that it will cache for some period of time, and someone could then retrieve it, or at least partially from your cache. But if you pin it, it then stays there long term so that folks can access it. So, you know, if you're using a data set or you're storing it for long term because you have used it, well, why not pin it then? Or if mm-hmm. you just have some free space and you want to help out the community, why not, you know, pin it for some period of time? So as an individual, it's like, okay, I grabbed like, you know, it's just 2% of the data, but that 2% is available. And if everyone does that, especially if it's a data set for an area that's popular, right? So, you know, geospatially, like, things happen on the earth, right? Things happen and then we're interested in them and everyone's interested in them. So there's hotspots where mm-hmm. everybody wants the data. So I think that's where you can really have the knock-on effects, is that if there's a hotspot and more people are sharing it, then it makes the data even more accessible there, instead of everybody making all these round trips back to the same place for the data.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's also about, just increasing the accessibility by multiple people sharing that data. How does that make the data more accessible versus like AWS sharing that data?
So, I mean, one of the things potentially is in terms of cost. So I speak mm-hmm. carefully because right now the data, at least parts of it, there's no cost associated with getting it, especially if you want to use it within their server in your region. So there's no fee to move it into your own instance, and then you pay to compute on top of it. So, but those things have changed over time because at some point, Landsat is the data I speak about the most because it's the one we're playing with. It was totally free to grab. Now, I think it's requester pays buckets. So there is some fee associated with getting that down. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're using IPFS, there's no fee associated with that. So that's one area. The other area that's really interesting is when you think about centralized infrastructure, you know, at like a single point or central point of failure, right? Like if there's some kind of natural disaster going on and you're not in a place that has strong centralized infrastructure, it can actually be quite a load if everyone's trying to get the same geospatial data, let's say data about, you know, a city where something has occurred, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're using decentralized sharing, right, everyone sharing with each other, it can actually reduce the load that everyone's making to that central point. So that's another interesting area where I think these types of technologies can be really useful.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it does increase efficiency also by, yeah, making sure that things that are popular are like very accessible, and then things that aren't popular like don't need that same level of like support. Whereas I guess as a centralized storage provider, you're just like making everything as accessible as you can. So yeah, sounds pretty efficient.
Yeah. And I mean, like on AWS and other providers, they have like smart tiering, intelligent tiering, where not all data is as accessible. They have, I think the product was called Glacier. It can take a little bit of time to retrieve the data. And so that's where you have, you know, things like Filecoin as like a persistent storage layer on top of IPFS. So we've been thinking about, you know, like how could you balance like layers, basically keep most of the data in cold-ish storage, you know, where it would take some time to retrieve, and then the stuff that's more popular is more accessible because there's a time element as well, right? And so you've got all this data, you know, Landsat goes back to 1972 and it changes with different iterations of the satellites. So there are some changes in that, but you can go back pretty far, but I'm guessing that the further you go back in time, the less popular the data is. There are some people doing longitudinal studies, but, you know, folks are really interested in the data that's come down, you know, in the last few months, last year, the year before that. So perhaps we don't need to have all of that data pinned, but the stuff that's more popular when it becomes more popular, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let's dive into that a little bit deeper. So how would decentralized approaches potentially help us to make that data not only available, but maybe also save costs?
So the saving cost is a good question. It's hard to pin the cost of what some of these things are, right? So like it distributes the cost. If we're all pinning it and saving it and sharing it, somebody's, you know, still using bandwidth, but we're not all doing a round trip, which is useful. We're not all. And the other part is then, you know, with Filecoin, it's kind of a decentralized storage network. And so the idea is there'd be some kind of market effect where the price of storage is more directly pinned to the demand and availability rather than, you know, whatever a couple of key central providers decide it should cost. And so there's always like, you know, we experience this all over, but even at the university, a product is like free or you pay a subscription and it's like unlimited storage. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, you can have 100 gigabytes, then you have to pay more. And so, you know, you're always subject to like what they're going to tell you that things are going to cost, especially when you become kind of dependent on it. So it does provide an alternative there. I think it's hard to say flat out like that will be cheaper, but I think it has the potential there to not necessarily have to cost as much. We've always thought as like a cool thought experiment, like if you could have a collection of organizations or, you know, universities storing this data and just take a data set and chunk it up, right, with some redundancy. So if there's 10, we don't all have 10%, but maybe we each have 20%. And we pin it, right? And then there's no need for everyone to store 100% of the data.
Yeah.
Or to go get it from someone else. You know, you've got trusted university partners. So I think that's like one idea where it could potentially be cheaper, you know, if it's popular enough data that everyone's using it. But, you know, universities have naturally, I think, been stewards of, you know, knowledge, information, data. And so that I think that could make some sense. But, you know, there's always issues with university IT and getting these types of new technologies, you know, set up and opening things up to the world and stuff like that. Some challenges to be overcome, but I think that, you know, that could be an interesting way. And we've also always thought, well, okay, there's the Eros data center, which is where you can get the Landsat data through an API. You do have to sign up and become approved, but I understand why they would want to do that. That's the USGS, because it's a lot of bandwidth to have to manage if it was just open all the time. And that's expensive, right? Like that's taxpayer dollars paying for that. So, but we wondered like, it'd be neat if they could have an IPFS node running underneath that. That would allow folks to grab the data that they need that way and then hopefully pin it back to the network and share it rather than going to them and grabbing it and keeping it for themselves in a, you know, from one silo to another.
Right. Exactly. So, and in that context, so one of the things that you talked about in your seminar was this concept of the least recently used cage, so the LRU. Can you maybe dive into that a little bit? So what is that thing and what is it good for?
Yeah, that's one of a few ideas we've been thinking about in terms of like balancing those layers or intelligent tiering, but on the, you know, using decentralized protocols. And so in that example, it doesn't even necessarily have to be decentralized, right? It could be a commonly shared, you know, S3 bucket, like a mm-hmm. cluster on AWS, could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. But the idea again was like, okay, rather than all of us storing our own data, like what if we had, you know, a central data purse, basically, right? We share the costs together and whatever is popular stays in there. So the least used is like, if nobody uses it, then we stop, you know, we stop making it as accessible. It might go back into cold storage or something like that.
Right.
So if somebody, you know, brings it in, that's fine. They paid the cost to bring it in, maybe to pin it or keep it in S3 bucket for a little while. If nobody else then requests it, after a while, it goes away. But if somebody else requests it, right, then perhaps they can help pay for the cost of keeping it there a little longer.
Exactly.
So, mm-hmm. you know, if we're all using IPFS, then, you know, we're just paying for the cost of our own bandwidth, whatever it is, our own power. But it could even be using some centralized technology, but just with decentralized management, decentralized stewardship. So something that we've been exploring, but it would require quite the community to kind of put together and try out. That's why we've been using simulations. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. But the simulations look very impressive.
Well, it's just interesting because, you know, we have to kind of like define everything that we're working with. We don't have like these known constructs. We're like, okay, well, what would the benefit be? We don't just want to say cost because we don't have, you know, numbers that we can pin to it. So we think of like, you know, how many free requests would there be? Essentially, like how many times would a data set be requested that's already being shared to the network or pinned or whatever it is. So that's like the metric that we've used, but we basically just had to like come up with that because there's no other way to think about it. No one's thought about how do you measure those benefits. And so we're trying to think about ways that we could measure like, well, what would the benefit be to adopting a system like this?
And what are the benefits? So what did you come up with in your simulations?
Well, that idea of like the number of, we call them free requests. They don't have to be free, but repetitive requests, right? Like how many times would that cache basically be an asset? Would somebody make a request for a data set and it be in the cache rather than in a central server, siloed at a cost, whatever the blocker might be to somebody grabbing that data. So that's the one that we've landed on so far. I mean, the other one is time, right? It could just be that you pin something for, you know, X number of months and then it goes away, becomes mm-hmm. kind of ephemeral. But that one's a little bit harder to measure too, because like what's the appropriate time, right? Like it's, mm-hmm. you would need some user data to kind of update that layer in real time. And I've talked to a few people who might have some interesting kind of data that they can share that we can even use to approximate kind of like user behavior in that sense. But we've just been making assumptions about like, okay, how many requests do we think might be made, you know, over time. And so it's a bit rough at the moment, but the nice thing about simulations is you can just do a sweep of parameters and check different things. So it's still pretty early kind of days there, but it's an interesting way to try and assess these things and hopefully come up with something convincing that can say, hey, look, this can be a useful thing to try, right? Like, let's try it out. You know, maybe we can get a bunch of people together and say, why don't we do this instead of this and see what happens. Mm-hmm.
So are there any examples of projects, maybe in very different spaces, but trying to do a similar thing of like increasing efficiency by decentralizing the access to certain things? Like, are there any other projects that you know of that maybe your project could learn from and maybe also use some data for your simulation for?
Yeah. So in terms of projects, an interesting one is, I'm not going to remember exactly. It's through like the UN has like a smart GIS, I believe, a smart GIS or open GIS initiative. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking, they're using something called PM Tiles, which is a really efficient way of serving up geospatial data, packaging it. And so they're serving up through that file format then on IPFS, some, I think it was land parcel data. as kind of like a test case of basically, can we have a web app that draws that data, that makes it available? So you basically can find that data like through your browser, just like you would in many other applications, but mm-hmm. it's actually being served up on IPFS. So I think it's being served from a Raspberry Pi as well. So it's a really interesting use case for that idea of like, if you didn't have access to like the centralized infrastructure, either because infrastructure is down or the connection's slow or whatever it is, you can set up a couple of these kind of Raspberry Pis more locally, having that data and people could grab it. So I think that's a really neat one that shows like the feasibility of potentially some of these decentralized technologies. But there's certainly other projects in the geospatial realm that we've kind of been following and we think are really interesting. I don't know if they speak to the idea of like long-term storage, but they're also using decentralized protocols for different geospatial problems. So the one that comes to mind is it's called Foam is the name of the company. So they're doing, they call it proof of location is kind of the consensus mechanism. This idea that they use long range radios to basically measure the distance to something that's broadcasting its location. You need, I believe, 4 of them, and you can basically then triangulate, or it's not a triangle if it's 4, I guess, but find out, they can agree that something is where it says it is. So they've got that with a kind of crypto spatial coordinate system that basically has, it's going to operate with the blockchain and the consensus mechanism proof of location. And so this idea that we can guarantee that something is where it says it is, right? So quintessentially geospatial. We've been talking about data that just kind of exists statically.
Yeah.
But you can think of geospatial data as moving objects as well, you know, where something is in time and space. So tons of applications come to mind, whether it's like tracking, you know, your Uber driver or like a delivery mm-hmm. to, shipping, right? And transport of goods and stuff like that, valuable things. And so lots of different stuff that we always want to track and know where it is, but you can have a decentralized network of basically operators and actors, people both doing the proof of location and then those who want to consume that kind of geospatial information. So that's a really neat one.
Interesting.
That we've been just kind of following. I don't know that it necessarily connects into the storage component of the story, but
right.
I think, you know, if you think of geospatial data kind of use, there's a life cycle and that's collecting geospatial data, you know, storing it, kind of processing it, but using it for an analysis and then maybe archiving it later on. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. there's like different pieces to the whole spatial data life cycle. And I think different projects kind of speak to different portions of that. And I think the more we have the whole cycle, you know, introducing different decentralized technologies, we're just like improving that ability to use those vital data sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trying to think of a few others. I know there's the Astral project. And so that's kind of an open source, I guess you'd call it like a collective. There's a bunch of individuals who are working in the realms of, they call it like Web3 native or Web3 geospatial. So, you know, the stuff that we've been doing is connecting Web2 and Web3 kind of. We're taking some of the current standards and we're kind of looping in some of the Web3 stuff. They've been looking a lot more at Web3 native stuff, integration for geospatial. So geospatial computing on the blockchain, smart contracts, this that's for building dApps down the road, I guess, as it becomes more efficient and more possible to have your entire application running, you know, on the blockchain with smart contracts. You can think of different problems with borders, different zones where you want different rules to be assessed. And so you can have that all kind of governed through the blockchain and managed decentrally.
Yeah,
decentralized, not really centralized, managed in a decentralized way.
Yeah. Another thing that you talked about in the seminar was this concept of spatial queries. So I'd love to dive into that a little bit more. So maybe let's start with describing what is a spatial query. And then I would love to know what makes spatial queries difficult in centralized protocols that are being used nowadays. And how can decentralized approaches actually help there?
Yeah, sure. So spatial querying is basically selecting a subset of data, right? We're asking, you know, where something is, or, you know, which mm-hmm. pieces of data fulfill something, but in a way that's geographical. So, you know, which data is within this parcel, or which data is nearby to some other data. Those are some classic, mm-hmm. you know, forms of spatial queries. So it sounds really trivial, but, you know, when you've got millions of data points, these become pretty tricky computational problems. And thankfully, there's been lots of ways to optimize those queries, things like spatial indexing. So the way that you group data and store it in, with some of that grouping information allows you then to retrieve it more quickly, more efficiently. So that's another area where I'd say it's not that querying in a centralized way is necessarily hard, but on the decentralized side, if we want some of those knock-on effects, if we want some of those benefits, it's quite hard to work with the geospatial data because we don't have those querying capabilities that we do in the centralized realm. Mm-hmm. So that's where we've been thinking about, well, could we bring some of it over there, right? We've got these great systems. So, you know, it works in both ways. Can we bring the decentralization to the traditional systems, but also can some of the traditional stuff help the decentralized systems?
Yeah.
So integrating in both directions. And so we were looking at, you know, could we integrate this idea of a discrete global grid, which can act like a spatial index, as a way to group the data so that we could then ask geospatial queries of the data on IPFS. Otherwise, it's quite tricky to interact with that metadata. So kind of having the data be recognized in a way that we're used to playing with it in our traditional centralized databases.
Interesting. And so my understanding was that the decentralized approach actually opens up new ways how you can index that, or is that is it just a different way of basically doing the same thing?
I guess it's not terribly different. The one different piece of it was that we could make a query just on the metadata itself, just by the way we were grouping it. So we were saying, well, that's interesting. Like, you don't need to have the whole data set then. Right. If you have just a little bit of the metadata, we have enough that we can make a rough spatial query, and then we can request a subset of the data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in a centralized database, you have everything there. Right. It's all stored, and then you're asking a question. You're receiving a subset of the data, but it is all stored. In this case, you could have multiple people, you know, storing and sharing the data in IPFS, and you're just trying to figure out, well, which chunk of that data do I need? Mm. And so it's like you can ask the question. And then you can grab the data, and you could grab the data from a bunch of, you know, whoever's got those pieces of it. But it kind of removes this need to have all of the data or to make a query across all the data. You're just kind of finding out which parts of it are pertinent based on the metadata itself. So the discrete global grid stuff, that's not, you know, new in the decentralized. Well, it's bringing it over there is new, but that in and of itself is not, you know, necessarily a new technology. You've got things like Uber's H3 and Google's got S2. So there's a bunch of these different systems that have been put together for spatial. Well, there's indexing, yeah, and then there's the discrete global grid. So they can act as a spatial index, but you've got things like Quadtrees and others, R-trees, that are kind of dynamic indices. So they change based on as you add data and take it out. Whereas mm-hmm. some of these other, like H3, S2, the geohash, those are kind of static, right? So they're just basically bins, and we bin the data, we group it in these different either squares or rectangles.
Right. So I wanted to know, you mentioned this concept and project that you guys have been trying of using decentralized storage in order to increase efficiency by not storing all of the derivative data products that are produced out of raw data, but instead having the raw data, having the data pipelines, and then every time you need a data product, you basically reproduce it. Is this, first of all, is that a correct summary of what you guys have been attempting? And then please tell us more about it. How does it work and does it work?
So yeah, that's a good summary. That's a really good kind of overview of it. So we've not done any of that yet. So that's kind of okay. Like looking to the future. We're like, okay, well, if we've got these different, you know, storage mechanisms, and we have things like Web3 native capabilities for finding these different components and executing code or instructions, well, that seems like one way to like pull it all together. And then it ties back into this idea of storage while you're reducing a storage footprint. Mm-hmm. So instead of storing, you know, and when we say derivative data product or data, we just mean like you have one data set and you create a new one based off of the old one, but it's the same size. It may not be, you know, the same size, you know, completely, but it's more or less the same size. And so, you know, okay, when I've got two data sets, right, it starts to snowball down and
sounds very familiar.
We don't necessarily need it all at the same time.
Yep.
Some of it we may never need. It's great that we created it. We may be more interested in the creation, you know, the way that we created it than necessarily what came out of it for a long time. And so, yeah, the idea was like, okay, well, if we've got the data stored somewhere, and again, it can be stored in multiple places, but it'd be nice if it did use some decentralized storage and got those benefits, but we can have the instructions on chain stored in a transparent, immutable way to where that data lives or exists. And then we can have instructions, you know, where do I find the code that could create that derivative data product? So, right, it's an input and then it's an instruction. We want the output. And so I think it's probably feasible to do now. And if it's not, I think it should be soon with a lot of the stuff that's being developed. And so I think for like academic publishing, it makes sense, right? We have a lot of stuff that we want to store with fidelity over time. And so we don't necessarily need it, but we want it to be there in case we do. And so that to me, that made sense as like a potential mechanism for doing that as like a research artifact, right? Other than just storing everything that goes with every publication, at least for some of these areas where like, you know, Landsat and Sentinel data, those are two core instruments that are being used by a lot of folks. So it's kind of like these common denominators essentially. And so you can think of it then as like a network of data products, right? And if you can find these central ones that are at the root, like those ones we store persistently over time. And some of the other ones, we just store the instructions to create them as needed. And it ties into that spatial temporal aspect, right? So we might just need some of that derivative data product for a certain place at a certain time, but not necessarily everywhere. So
I guess that this makes particularly sense if the data derivative product has not been very computationally expensive, right? So I think that the calculation probably changes if your data processing pipeline is very expensive.
Yeah, there's a trade-off, right? Yeah. So, and again, you wouldn't want to do this all of the time, right? So that's where I think having some kind of like holding layer, right? If you're going to do this, you create the data set and then it is stored for, you know, 6 months or a year in case somebody else wants it. So you're not always doing that computation if it's if it's heavier. So and for experimental data sets too, right? That's where I think it makes sense is like, if we know that the output is like exactly what we want and folks are going to use that for a long time, then yeah, let's store it because we need it. But if it's more of an experimental one where it's like, you know, we've created this, it might be useful. You know, we're still working on new methods, right? So it's like, you don't need to store that one forever. But it, you know, if we do want to recreate it, it'd be nice. It kind of ties into that reproducibility and replicability theme of science.
So about that reproducibility aspect, let's assume the technology allows for that to happen. How good is geospatial science at reproducibility? Like if we just now put up all the data pipelines that the community is producing and using, would we be able to get all the data sets that are currently being stored and shared somewhere? Would we be able to reproduce them? What's your, you don't have data on this, but like, what's your gut feeling?
Yeah, no, I don't have any hard kind of data there. I mean, I think the geographical sciences are kind of mirroring many of the other sciences where I think always things like reproducibility have been important, but they kind of like ebb and flow in popularity. And when new technologies come out, then folks advocate for them. And it almost becomes more of a social issue, right? It's like, we have these things, we have preprint servers, we have, you know, GitHub repositories, we have version control, but it takes a lot of training and you know, the more time you spend on that, the less time you can spend on the science itself. And so there's always a balance on those things. So I think, you know, decentralized stuff is in academia, my experience so far is that not that many folks know about it. So there's an education problem and a social problem is trying to expose folks to it, the potential benefits, trying to get some buy-in there. But I think right now there's quite a push to make things more reproducible, more replicable. A lot more journals are requiring data to be stored, submitted and stored, code to be submitted and stored. And so there is more support for that. I just think that innovating some of those protocols is sometimes takes time and energy to push that. So yeah, you know, even if we create it, it's going to take some time before I think people might use it or adopt it into those workflows. But I'm hopeful. I think that it'd be kind of neat. And, you know, everyone says that we're going to have these deluges of data. And so that's where I think some of these things would come in, right? We're not necessarily solving the problem that's here now, but thinking out to the future what some of the problems might be and how we can accommodate them. So that can be even trickier, I think, to get folks to think that far in advance. Because I do think probably not just in the geographical sciences, but calls for reproducibility in science are usually more of an answer to a problem after we detect it. Like it's become a problem, right? We find out there's a bunch of studies that didn't replicate or reproducibility is not as good as we would have hoped in today's day and age with our technology. So I know it's kind of neat to make it like a first-class citizen in terms of a problem. Like let's think out, like how can we get out ahead of it? Make things more replicable before it's an issue, before it's a problem.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm totally with you on that. So what do you think? I mean, you already talked about like some of the barriers to making that happen, right? So you said that it's partly it's cultural, it's social, it's educational. So from your own experience, where do you think would be good leverage points to actually improve the adoption of like reproducible methods for science, for data sharing, for producing results?
That's a tricky question. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of things there. That's the part of it is, you know, you have like the storage component and that's, you know, questions of access and there's even questions of like power and control and, you know, potentially cost. But then you have, you know, in science, it's like, well, we need things to replicate to be, you know, certain that we're building knowledge there. And that then becomes more of a social thing. So I don't know, the biggest blocks to, you know, there's on the one hand, R&R, I'll just abbreviate R&R more generally, right? Like we're dealing with that now. And that's, I think, more of like, it's not technical, right? Because we have things like Docker and we have, you know, cloud compute and we have, I think that stuff right now is probably more social, it's educational and like valuing those contributions in science, right? Because that's always a problem. Like, you know, in academia, you're looking to get tenure and then eventually some promotions. And like that stuff's not always necessarily valued. I think some of it's coming around. So that's kind of one issue now, but then looking out to the future, it's like, well, how do you get folks to invest in something that they may not necessarily have that problem right now. But I think, you know, you think about, again, like scientists, like they want to collaborate. They usually have a collaborative experience. And so if you put a technology in front of them, someone and say like, hey, use this, it won't be that different than your user experience now, but you could be like seeding a cool new community. I think typically you'll find scientists to be receptive to that. And so I think that's like the area to explore. And that's what we've been trying to do is like find ways to build these in where it's not a ton of overhead, right? It's not super complicated. It's not going to cost them a lot to get involved. Right. Just something they could kind of play with and see if they can get personally excited about it, if it's something useful for them. And, you know, of course, when big problems arise, right? Like we're saying some of these decentralized tools can be useful like in a crisis or something, right? So a problem arises and then it creates like a strong need is another way that, you know, adoption is driven. But it's a multi-pronged problem. And I don't know that I have good answers. I see the challenges. I think just using it and being an advocate for it and sharing it with others and seeing if they're excited about it.
Yeah, that sounds great. And very insightful. I think you're probably right about that. So this collaborative gene in scientists, I think we can probably nurture its effects a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there's history there, right? Like, you know, the the original like email system, the internet, right? Wasn't it? It's what developed by DARPA or something, a precursor to DARPA, but then it was adopted by, you know, universities and mm-hmm. they were using it. So they've always been kind of like a test bed for trying out new things to connect and collaborate.
Yeah,
for sure.
Super cool. Yeah. Okay. So I think the time has come for us to shift to our lightning round.
Oh, so, right.
So we have five short questions for you, and we would like to get very short answers, like ideally a yes or no, one word, if it's possible. So let's see
what we can do. No problem.
You want to kick us off?
I'll try.
Yeah. This one is not going to be yes or no, so that's not going to work. But which scientist influenced your own scientific work the most?
Oh, that's such an interesting one. Well, I've got... I guess I could say, I can't say ex-supervisor, but I have a supervisor. He was my master's supervisor, and then he's now in industry. And so his name is Carson Farmer. So he mm-hmm. was, he is a geographer, but working in the Web3 kind of space. So he's the one who introduced me to a lot of this stuff and got me interested in it. So yeah, I'm going to give him a shout out there.
Amazing. Next one. What's your favorite part about being a scientist?
So one of my favorite things is kind of the freedom to think about things from whichever angle you mm-hmm. think fits the problem, right? You get to define the problem and then you get to kind of try different methods to solve it. So developing new methods, I always think the coolest thing is I'm like, well, how, you know, we can apply this to lots of stuff, right? Like this could be used for criminology, could be used for epidemiology. So I think that keeps you from ever being able to be bored. You know, you're just thinking about mm-hmm. all these different things and you have that freedom and latitude.
Totally.
Yeah,
agree.
For sure. And so if and when science ever does bore you, what's your most unscientific hobby or interest?
At the moment, I would say one of those hobbies is probably sampling the best pizza that I can find.
That's a great hobby.
I don't make pizza myself anymore, right? Not able to do that. Not able to do that much cooking, but still super appreciative of it. So I've always, my partner and I have always talked about like, oh, we should open a pizza shop. So if I wasn't doing this, maybe I'd be doing that. With them.
That's amazing. What's your approach? Do you always get the same type of pizza everywhere and then have like a, is that your bar? Also, what is the best pizza you've ever had?
Ever had is a hard one. So it's like, you know, there are different styles, right? So different things. So it always helps to be with, you know, at least one or more people to be able to sample stuff. But mm-hmm. we recently discovered a place in downtown DC called La Casina that makes a Roman style pizza called pinza rather than pizza.
Yeah.
The dough is a little mm-hmm. slightly different kind of components, I guess, different ingredients, but it was just beautiful. Awesome. Run by an Italian couple. And it was just the best pizza that we've had, I think. Lots of other good pizza as well. So.
Okay, next one. Are you a city or a countryside guy?
These days, definitely a city guy, for sure. I appreciate the countryside and spend some time in different places that were pretty rural. But just love going to concerts and having that kind of urban mm-hmm. buzz.
Do you have a favorite city?
I'm biased. So I grew up, on Long Island, just in the shadows of New York City. And right. So for me, I love every time I can go back there and kind of feel that energy.
Yeah. New York's great. So last question, if you could have any superpower, which one would it be?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I don't know if I have a quick answer to that. I'm going to dwell on it for a second.
Fair enough.
You know, people typically go for like flying or being able to do mm-hmm. that. I always feel like I wish I had more time. I don't know if I had, you know, multiple of myself.
Oh, that's a smart one. I like that. Yes, bend time.
Yeah, I just always feel like I just don't have, you know, enough time in the day to do everything I would want to do.
Yeah.
To have multiple of yourself. So I don't know, to be able to tap into the multiverse.
Yep. That sounds great. Okay, cool. I would totally join you in that experiment.
I got asked the other day, it's like, do you believe in the multiverse? And I was like, well, I don't know. Like, probabilistically speaking, it sounds convincing. That would be neat. But I don't know. Yeah. So bring that to fruition.
I want to believe in it.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Taylor. This was a great podcast. We learned a lot from you. Also, I'm pretty hungry for pizza now, so I think it's time for us to wrap up.
It's lunchtime here. It's probably, you know, happy hour approaching dinner time over there. So,
yep.
Thanks so much for joining us, Taylor. This was fantastic. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Taylor. Thanks for listening to the Future of Science podcast. If you like this episode, please remember to review and subscribe to this podcast. You can learn more about the DeSci Foundation at DeSciFoundation.org. See you next time.